This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Between October and December 2003 at the Abu Ghraib confinement facility, numerous incidents of sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses were inflicted on several detainees. This systematic and illegal abuse of detainees was intentionally perpetrated by several members of the Military Police Guard Force. Those words are taken from a report ordered by the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, and written by Major General Antonio Taguba. They were first published in the New Yorker magazine. The general writes that the charges are substantiated by detailed witness statements, including full and complete confessions by some of those involved, and documented by what are described as extremely graphic photographic evidence. Some of those pictures were broadcast last week on CBS TV's 60 Minutes 2 and subsequently shown around the world. Some soldiers face court-martial. Others have been reprimanded, including the commander of the MP unit, Brigadier General Janis Kopinski, but many questions remain. Did the problems lie with just the MPs or, as General Kopinski charges, with MI, military intelligence? What role did civilian interrogators play, and who are they answerable to? What does the law say about the line between interrogation and torture, and were the alleged abuses confined to this prison in this time frame? As we try to explore these questions, we may have to describe some of the deeds alleged, a discussion that may not be suitable for everyone listening, and certainly not for children. If you have questions about what happened and why, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is T. Christian Miller, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times who's read the Army's 53-page report on alleged abuse at Abu Ghraib prison, and he joins us from his office here in Washington. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Your paper has reported that the Army's Investigation Board found, as we said, systematic and illegal abuse. What do we know for sure about the types of abuse that the prisoners had to endure at Abu Ghraib?
We know from the basis of statements that were made in that investigative report, as well as other reporting we've done, that there were a number of incidents that occurred in the fall that have been portrayed quite graphically, as you mentioned, that involved essentially trying to humiliate the prisoners by stripping them naked and forcing them to simulate various sexual acts in an attempt to, as some of the soldiers put it, as an attempt to soften up the prisoners prior to their interrogation.
And the allegations listed, punching, slapping, kicking detainees, jumping on their naked feet, videotaping and photographing naked male and female detainees, forcibly arranging detainees. It goes on in some detail, and all of which is, in some, it's sickening. But what was the reason given, if any, for this kind of behavior?
The reason that has been given is that these military police were preparing these prisoners for questioning sessions with both private government contractors who were conducting interrogations with these detainees, as well as with military intelligence officials who were conducting interrogations as well. And so prior to their entering what's called Tier 1A, and in the Tier 1A area where their questioning was occurred, these inmates were subjected to a variety of quite degrading, horrifying, in some cases, acts in order to prepare them for the questioning and make them more pliant.
And did the MPs allegedly come up with these alleged abuses on their own, or were they instructed?
Well, Neil, that's one of the big unanswered questions. As one of the lawyers put it, how is it possible that these MPs, who are essentially reservists from the Appalachian Mountains, knew that it was particularly humiliating in Muslim culture to strip naked and have men do these kind of acts? The suggestion there is obviously that this was an idea that was planted to these military police officers in an attempt to steer them in a direction to go.
Another question about what the MPs did. I guess by now most everybody's seen the pictures that wants to. Why were the pictures taken?
I have heard a variety of stories on that, and the family members, at least, and the charged soldiers, their story, and you can take it for what it's worth, their story is that this is a one-time occurrence. These pictures were taken in an attempt to use them with future prisoners and show future prisoners, here's what's going to happen to you if you don't talk. And so it was a one-time isolated incident. It was going to be used to intimidate prisoners in the future with photographic evidence. Of course, the other side of the story is that This is an out-of-control unit of military police officers that should well have known that what they were doing is wrong, and obviously just went off track and were seen in the pictures giving the thumbs up, smiling, grinning, as these obviously humiliating acts are taking place.
How did this story come out? What was it that prompted the investigation, General Sanchez, to order this investigation in the first place?
It's a two-stage process. There was in the fall, within the military police company, the 372nd, that was accused of committing these acts, there were some soldiers who were simply horrified by it. And the good side of the story is that some of these 376 soldiers acted as whistleblowers and came forward to report these incidents using a compact disc, actually, that was made with some of these images that had been circulated among the soldiers. So that got the military investigating. Now, after some of the MPs were arrested, they then went through various channels to the media because, in their perception, they have been railroaded and unfairly treated in that they have been accused of crimes, but none of their superior officers, who they say were suggesting these types of behaviors, have been made to suffer the consequences.
And one of the things that we have learned was that there was at the very least, a muddled chain of command at the prison. Brigadier General Karpinski, who commanded the military police reservists, said that, in fact, military intelligence ran that part of the prison and that they were in charge of what the MPs did down there.
That's correct. In fact, that's one of the main focuses of the military report that the LA Times and other media have obtained, is that there was an order given at one point in time to place the military police officers under the command of a military intelligence unit, and that muddled chain of command, as you quite correctly described it, is responsible for some of the behaviors we saw.
There are allegations of abuse that lie outside of this particular investigation, so at least allegations that this went on beyond that particular time frame and that particular prison, including allegations of a man who died.
Yes, that might be the most serious allegation that I've seen outside of this investigation, Neil. One of the sergeants, Staff Sergeant Chip Frederick, who is the leader of the group that's accused here, says that on at least one occasion he saw a prisoner go in alive to an interrogation session and come out dead. That accusation is backed up at least partially by the fact that the CIA has its own Inspector General investigation ongoing into the death of a prisoner during an interrogation in the U.S. Prison there in Abu Ghraib in the fall. Don't know if they're one and the same. We hope that there's not two interrogations where prisoners ended up dying, but at least we know that there is an official investigation underway into the death of a prisoner during an interrogation at that prison as well. So it's not just confined to what we've seen so far. There seems to be a lot of evidence that there was many other things that have gone badly wrong at that prison.
And indeed, a British newspaper has published pictures that are not all that dissimilar, involving British interrogations of Iraqi detainees.
Yeah, that's correct. That was in another facility in the south involving some British troops earlier last summer, actually. But there have been allegations, certainly, of abuse at other prisons that have been sustained. There was recently a court-martial for some troops that were accused of slapping and punching prisoners in another prison in the south, U.S. troops. And there was a well-known trial of a colonel who discharged his firearm in an attempt to scare an Iraqi into giving more intelligence information as well. So there have been other incidents that have been taking place in the prison system, which I'm told in general was kind of a bright blinking light that was not being paid close attention to by anybody in the top command, because they were obviously occupied with other phases of the Iraq situation.
One of the things that people have been most curious about is the involvement of civilians in this process. There were apparently two categories of civilians, interrogators and interpreters.
Yes, we're told that there was two companies that are specifically involved in these incidents. One is Titan Corporation of San Diego, and the second is CACI, or CACI, as it's sometimes referred to, in Virginia. The two companies, Titan supplied translators. They do that all over Iraq. That's not unusual. Titan has one of the main contracts to supply in translator services to U.S. troops. So they were apparently acting as translators during the interrogations. But then the more curious example is CACI, who apparently were helping to conduct, or actually conducting, interrogations out of this prison. And that's more of an unusual that I hadn't heard of before, is a private company conducting military interrogations.
And an emailer who calls himself Travis McGee, perhaps not his real name, asks a question that's on a lot of people's minds. Why are private contractors even involved in military intelligence activities?
That's an excellent question. I've been told that essentially what you have out of that prison is you have the largest set of detainees that the U.S. has handled possibly since Vietnam. They were overwhelmed and not prepared for it, and so they had to reach out to the private contractor community to supplement the ranks of military interrogators that were on hand and within the U.S. military.
Does the Taguba report address this issue or just say that they were involved?
It says they were involved. It makes mention of the fact that civilian contractors who are doing interrogation should be more closely supervised and there should be a clear chain of command, which is one of the issues here. Is it's unclear whether or not these civilian contractors are going to face any sort of investigation, much less have to account for what they've done.
We'll have more on that in a few minutes. But let's take some calls and get some listeners involved. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Mike, who joins us from Columbia, Maryland.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call, sir.
Sure.
I just had a question. Your guests have mentioned earlier that these pictures that were taken were perhaps being used to, you know, show future, you know, incoming detainees that perhaps this is what's going to happen to you, essentially, if you don't cooperate and provide the information. I would like to know, because as an American, I'm very disturbed by these pictures. That's not standard military practice, is it? I mean, where in other cases has this been used to sort of force detainees, future incoming detainees, that this is what's going to happen to them if they don't cooperate? It's very disturbing to me. I'll take my response off the air.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Mike, thanks for the call. Go ahead, T.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Mike. I am not aware of other incidents, and you have to recall that description of these pictures were taken to use other employees. You have to understand that was coming from the family members,
mm-hmm.
And so you have to take that as they obviously have an interest in getting out their side of the story and making their defense. I don't disagree with them. I'm just saying that you should always be aware of where this information is coming from. But I don't know of any other incidents I've heard of, and nor do I think it is standard military practice to first use photos and then take them going forward. And I think Mike brings up an interesting point that you're seeing a lot of outrage from all sides, both Americans and in the Arab world, at these pictures because they're so out of line.
An email question from Lucia Mudd in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Do we know who these prisoners were, are, combatants, civilians? What has happened to the abused prisoners? Apologies? Restitution?
That's a good question as well. At least what the military will have you believe that these are not white-collar detainees. These are the guys who are mounting shoulder-mounted rockets and shooting them at U.S. troops, and were trying to kill U.S. troops. And so from their point of view, these were the guys who have information about the insurgency, which is killing U.S. soldiers every day. And there was a pressure to get information from them to be able to attack the roots of that problem. That's the military story, that these people were not just sort of common criminals or they had stolen a head of lettuce from the market in Baghdad. These were people who were trying to kill U.S. Soldiers.
But presumably then civilians?
They were members of the insurgency. I don't know if that counts as civilians or not. They were guerrilla fighters.
Okay. T. Christian Miller, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Neil. I appreciate it.
T. Miller is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He covers civilian contractors and the reconstruction effort in Iraq, and he spoke with us from his office here in Washington, D.C. When we come back from a short break, what does international law have to say about the detention and interrogation of prisoners of war? Where is the line between responsible questioning and torture? The number to call is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about allegations of mistreatment and abuse of Iraqi prisoners. If you have questions about the Geneva Conventions and international laws covering the detention of prisoners, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Joining us now from his office here in Washington is Robert Goldman. He teaches the law of war at the American University, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here.
What do the Geneva Conventions say about the treatment of prisoners in an occupied country?
Right. Well, first of all, just to clarify that these people surely are not being held as prisoners of war. That's a very complex issue, but it's clear that the way they're fighting, the way they're dressed, concealment of weapons would not entitle them to be protected under the Third Convention. However, civilians who take up arms and can be treated or called as so-called unprivileged combatants are nonetheless, if captured by U.S. forces, entitled to protections under the Fourth Convention. That's the Civilian Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And
who gets to make that distinction?
The United States, the detaining power in this case, and the occupying power would make it. But the protections are frankly more or less the same.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of whether they were given protection under the Third Convention as prisoners of war or whether they're held as civilians under the Fourth Convention, even though they've committed hostile acts, they are required under all circumstances to be treated humanely. Now, it may be that because they have committed hostile acts against the occupying power that they will forfeit certain rights, but those rights do not include, for instance, the prohibition against physical or moral coercion against humane treatment. And indeed, the President of the United States, General Sanchez, and apparently that internal report, which was alluded to with your previous guest,
mm-hmm.
make very clear that these acts clearly were in violation of what our the law is. So this should not be a debate. The treatment by any standard was degrading, was inhuman. And depending on what report that you read, it could certainly amount to, it's very much on the borderline of torture in certain circumstances, because torture does not have to be the infliction of just physical pain. It can be the infliction of severe emotional pain.
An email question. Who has jurisdiction over any criminal charges? Who investigates? Who has jurisdiction over any civil action?
Well, the certainly with regular members of the armed forces, the in the line of command and so forth, our armed forces members are subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and that could trigger charges, and indeed charges, reprimands have been issued, but there's other ongoing investigations that can result in court-martial proceedings.
And indeed, six soldiers have been brought up on court-martial
charges. Precisely. Now, on the other hand, if you're dealing with CIA or if you're dealing with these civilian contractors, they are not subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And this is one of the problems that this war has raised, as well as the war in Afghanistan, the extent to which we are outsourcing to private groups. All of this tends to confirm that we went in, particularly into Iraq, with insufficient forces, which mm-hmm. is one of the reasons why you have all these private contractors who are doing things that ordinarily should be done to highly trained members of the armed forces, and particularly military intelligence, who should know, and I believe are trained, in what the Geneva Conventions require.
What do the conventions say about interrogation practices and how they're carried out? In other words, this psychological torture.
Well, right? the conventions are written in a general form, and that you have to sort of inform your content by what developments in the law are. And I think that when it prescribes in all circumstances any form of inhuman treatment, when it, in the case of civilians who are detained, and even arguably in the case of those who have committed hostile acts, such as resistance fighters or guerrillas, however you want to term, terrorists, however you want to qualify them, that no physical or moral coercion should be used against them for purposes of interrogation. In other words, they have to be humanely treated. And again, I think that the argument is basically over. I have heard, for instance, former intelligence people speaking to reporters who said, well, you know, we do this stuff, it's really on the line. Well, it seems to me when the President of the United States and that the commander of U.S. forces there say, this is illegal, this is unacceptable, that we know that these kinds of things are unacceptable. So obviously an investigation has to be undertaken. The problem is this outsourcing? These people aren't in the normal chain of command. And many of these things may border on war crimes if they're willfully committed and so forth against protected persons. But our military, the Uniform Military Code of Justice, cannot reach these private personnel, and it is doubtful, or certainly has never been determined, that U.S. laws dealing with trials for war crimes in this country could have extraterritorial reach into Iraq.
An email question about how the chain of command gets into this. This from Keith in Silver Spring, Maryland. The general in charge of the prison has ultimate responsibility. If she was intimidated by anyone else, she had no business being in charge. Claiming ignorance is no excuse and is the usual excuse of it was out of my hands. And lastly, he writes, I can't believe the top general in charge of the theater had not seen this report prior to these public releases.
Well, he makes a good point, or she makes a good point. The fact is, if the general thought that these civilian contractors or even military intelligence was far too aggressive and were engaging in illicit acts, then that should have been reported up the chain so that remedial action could have taken place. I think quite clearly the chain operational control, command and control here broke down.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is David, who's with us from Las Vegas.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had a comment and a question. First off, it seems as though one of the biggest reasons for going into Iraq was to stop this kind of punishment and this brutality. But when it's at the hands of somebody else, it's terrorism, and when we do it, it's not. So
this same prison, Abu Ghraib, was the source of torture by Saddam Hussein's jailers. But go ahead.
Exactly. And now we're doing the same thing. And the United States has constantly undermined international law. And it seems as though they're doing it again. And do you think there's any chance of reciprocity about this, or any steps going to be taken towards stopping the United States from breaking international law, or is it just going to be a constant thing from now on?
Robert Goldman?
Well, hopefully what we saw was an aberrational act. It needs to be investigated, and I certainly wouldn't equate, you know, the systematic murder and dismemberment and so forth of people by Saddam with this particular incident, but not in any way detracting from the gravity of the situation, number one. Number two, the caller has a very good point. The United States is a preeminent military power that projects our forces across the world, have a very strong interest in seeing that we uphold the law, the rule of law here in terms of applying the conventions. We objected, and properly so, at the beginning of the war when there were captive Americans and there were certain bodies of Americans that were shown on pictures that were shown, and we objected that these were violations of the convention. And obviously, if we do things like this, then you risk reciprocal treatment on the other side. I mean, can you imagine if the American contractor and so forth who had been captured instead of fortunately escaping, that the next thing we saw, that in response to what the Americans were doing, that we saw nude pictures of him and got electrodes on his genitals and so forth and so on, and saying, you do it to us, we're going to do it to you. And that is what you risk. In other words, we are at great risk, above all, as the principal military power, in not seeing to it that our commanders and so forth are going to ensure that we scrupulously apply the law. We can't very well demand scrupulous compliance when, for instance, we may be lax at times with our own compliance.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Delighted.
Robert Goldman, a law professor at American University. He spoke to us from his office here in Washington. And joining us now is Greg Hartley, a former U.S. Army interrogator, now a consultant at Team Delta. That's a private firm that runs interrogation workshops for law enforcement officers. And he joins us by phone from his office in Georgia. And very good of you to join us today.
Well, thanks for inviting.
As you've indicated, you have some experience in this area. I understand you interrogated prisoners during the first Gulf War. Is that right?
I did interrogate prisoners during the first war, and I was also involved fairly heavily with training reservists who are interrogators, so the reservist question becomes important to me.
Okay, and obviously during the first Gulf War, the prisoners you were interrogating were clearly members of the military?
Yes, clearly members of the military. And you have to understand that there were later insurgents who were in different places in Kuwait City and that kind of thing. We had at times problems with people who were carrying out what would be considered criminal acts by their local government, but overwhelmingly, the numbers of people we touched were uniformed military.
As a former interrogator, then, do these stories coming out of Iraq now sound typical to what your understanding is, what you saw, what you were taught?
Well, they're absolutely not typical. And again, having had the responsibility for teaching reservist interrogation for about 8 years, and having been through nearly every kind of interrogation training the U.S. Army has, I would mirror exactly what your last caller said, and that the military is trained about the law of land warfare. We actually have a field manual that addresses all of the issues on how do you handle a prisoner, who gets which status as far as detainee, prisoner of war, protected persons. All of those things are covered in a field manual.
And does it tell you what practices are allowed and which are not?
Well, just to tell you, it clearly says that you're not allowed to mentally nor physically torture a prisoner, and you're not allowed to coerce a prisoner. So if that's clear enough, that's the beginning of it.
And were you working for military intelligence at this time?
Absolutely.
And does the idea that we're hearing from Abu Ghraib prison, that military intelligence was telling these MPs to soften these guys up for interrogation, does that make sense to you?
No, it makes no sense to me. Typically, when you talk to an interrogator, interrogators rely, and I've read your flashback from the first Gulf War, so I have an idea what you've been through, and you know for yourself that the stress of being captured alone, it puts you in a different state of mind than you originally or normally would be in. You're out of cognizant thought, and you're now in limbic thought, and you get to a point that you can't think clearly. Why anyone would add to that by torment or doing something to cause pain or anything else to a prisoner, it harkens to say that either the people who are handling the prisoners are not well trained, or that there's some misunderstanding. I would tell you that reservist interrogators are trained well enough to know that they should never violate Geneva Convention. They also are taught very clearly what those lines are. We would not rely on a prison guard to make decisions about what was ethical or what was not, because we know that ultimately, when you have a prisoner in your hands, you're responsible for the welfare of that prisoner. And just not something you would see.
Just to clarify for those listeners who don't know, during the first Gulf War, I was captured by Iraqi forces and subjected to what I believe to be the probably the kindest and gentlest interrogation in the history of the Iraqi army. So whether I was thinking clearly or not, that's another issue.
Well, and the only reason I bring that up is because the state of mind that you're in, even though you may at some point believe that you're thinking clearly, is entirely different than your normal state of mind due to the stress and cortisol cycles and all those things that you're going through.
I can certainly testify as to the stress. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation, and we'll begin with Steve in St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
From what I've read and studied over the years, it seems to me there's a history of interrogation excesses in the military and the CIA, and that this is just one more instance of it. And when it comes to light, it seems it's always categorized as like an isolated incident, something way off the map that should never have happened. My question is simply, why isn't it understood that there is a culture of such excesses in both the military and the CIA?
And what I would tell you is that I do believe there is a possibility for this to happen anytime you're dealing with humans. Humans, by nature, that the old adage, absolute power corrupts absolutely. If you do not watch over people, people have a tendency to become power hungry. So it is incumbent upon the people who are in charge to watch very closely their charges, meaning whoever works for them, they need to watch very closely. I would say that when you get in a situation where you have an interrogator, and in particular, a prisoner handler who has less training, you need to watch them all the more closely, and it probably beckons for using psychologists in the compound to watch the mental health of people who are working day in, day out, 8 hours a day or more with prisoners.
Steve, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Greg Hartley, a former U.S. Army interrogator. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And another caller is with us, Nick in Marshall, Minnesota.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is not concerning current law, but just, I guess, the general psychology of interrogation. How far should we be able to go? I mean, the media, I guess popular media, is flooded with images of stuff like NYPD Blue and even stuff pertaining to the perceptions of police interrogations without the threat of some sort of consequence. are people going to give up vital information? These are people who are willing to shoot rockets into a pack of U.S. troops. Would they be willing to tell us what we need to know? How far should we be able to go? Are there other methods preferable to, I guess, time-tested torture?
And let me add, is the information you get from extreme interrogation, torture, if you will, is it worthwhile?
No, it's not, actually. If you study history, torturing people gets one thing. That's the answer you want to hear so that you will stop. Anxiety is probably the most powerful weapon you have as an interrogator. And you can imagine if everything that you know is suddenly turned upside down, you're going through high levels of stress, and the interrogator, the wise interrogator, uses that to his advantage in that he may come in or she may come in and lower that anxiety level. As a quick note, and to give you an example of how it would feel, if you're pulled over by a police officer and have no idea why, imagine what you feel like. Now compound that by 100 times because you're thoroughly out of control.
All right. Thank you for the insight.
Nick, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And let's talk now with Dennis. And Dennis is with us from Sedona, Arizona.
That's correct. I totally agree with the last two callers. But I'd like to look at the political side of this since they've covered the rest of it so well. Politically speaking, I wonder if this is a demonstration of the fact that the Bush administration is not in control of what's going on over there in many different venues, and it's being reflected here in one of them, but it may be evidence of the fact that there's a lot of trouble in a lot of areas of what's going on in Iraq, and we're just floating along with the balloon here and not knowing where it's going.
Well, could you focus that a little bit, Dennis?
Well, yeah. Are we hiring in people because we're so desperate because we can't get enough troops over there because we don't dare ask for them?
Civilian contractors, what are they doing there?
To take a step back, what I would say from that is the civilian contractors you're talking about typically are military trained, not meaning they've been trained since they started working for civilians. But if I were to decide tomorrow that I wanted to go to the Middle East to work as an interrogator, and I am qualified with the correct language skills, with the correct intelligence skills, then civilian contractors hire you at a much higher salary than we're paying our soldiers, and you can understand how that system works.
So it's not war on the cheap.
Excuse me?
It's not cheaper to use civilian contractors.
Oh, no, not by any stretch.
Okay. Greg Hartley, thank you for joining us today.
One last comment. I would tell you that any of this that you see happen, I would consider a breakdown, and there are a few things that could result in that breakdown. The first one is that the people are poorly trained. The second one is that they have a poor operating procedure for verifying and validating an interrogation plan before the source is brought in, and that could result in a loose cannon.
Greg Hartley, again, thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Greg Hartley, a former Army interrogator, now a consultant for Team Delta, and he joined us from that company's offices in Georgia. When we come back from a break, we'll continue this conversation with a spokesman from Amnesty International. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about allegations of detainee abuse at the hands of U.S. troops in Iraq. Joining us from his office in New York is William Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, the author most recently of Tainted Legacy, 9/11, and the Ruin of Human Rights. And it's good to talk to you again, Bill.
Good to talk to you, Neil.
Amnesty International has reported other instances of abuse in Iraq dating back to last summer, as well as instances in Afghanistan. Can you, as we try to get a picture of whether this, obviously this particular report focused on 2 months in one particular containment center outside of Baghdad, your picture's a little wider. Tell us what you think went on.
Yes. I don't mean to suggest that all U.S. interrogators use these practices. Of course not. But I do disagree with Professor Goldman's comment that this incident is not aberrational, or Mr. Hartley's comment that it is not typical, merely some loose cannons. Look, a year and a half ago, in December 2002, the Washington Post reported prolonged restraints that were being administered to al-Qaeda prisoners in Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, perhaps in Diego Garcia, beatings, prolonged hooding, exposure 24 hours a day to bright lights. March 2003, the New York Times reported something similar. It also talked about the fact that we were rendering prisoners to countries that utilized torture as a matter of common technique in their interrogations. Amnesty International reported on this in Iraq as long ago as a year ago. In February 2004, during a hearing into the death of a Iraqi prisoner at Camp Whitehorse Detention Center near Nasiriya, a former U.S. Marine testified that it was common practice to kick and punch prisoners who didn't cooperate. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have both documented these kinds of incidents fairly frequently in both Afghanistan and in Iraq, and elsewhere in U.S. custody with other prisoners. So this is, while of course not an everyday occurrence, it is certainly not aberrational, unfortunately.
And just to clarify for listeners, Diego Garcia, to which you referred, is an atoll in the middle of the Indian Ocean, a British possession, but now an entirely British and American military base.
Yes.
Some prisoners are believed to be held on Diego Garcia. Are you heartened, I guess, to hear the widespread denunciations, everybody from the president on down, of this latest incident?
Well, of course, that is encouraging. That's exactly what should happen. But I will point out that close to a year ago, human rights groups went to the Pentagon, to the National Security Council. The president himself issued a statement in which he indicated that this kind of behavior was utterly inappropriate. And, of course, it is seen to have continued long after that statement was issued. And one of the reasons, I'm afraid, is because those who undertake this kind of activity, whether they be the prison guards themselves or military intelligence or higher-ups, are able to get away with it. We have a case of two people who died at Bagram Air Force Base 2 years ago. Their deaths were ruled homicides, even though they were under U.S. custody. And still 2 years later, no one has been charged with that crime. We know of a U.S. Army lieutenant colonel who acknowledged that he had threatened to kill an Iraqi detainee by firing a shot next to the man's head during a violent interrogation. What happened to him? He received a fine. That was his disciplinary measure. He was not even court-martialed. So unfortunately, the fact is, no matter who does this, to this point, the record of the U.S. is not very good in making sure that whoever is responsible for it pays a price.
That last incident of the gunshot, that was a British officer, as I recall.
It was a U.S. Army lieutenant colonel. He admitted in August that he had...
Then there were two cases, a British one as well. David in Syracuse, New York, sends us this email. While I realize the politically correct view is to seek the heads of U.S. soldiers, I see nothing wrong with the behavior of the U.S. soldiers. Considering the treatment of U.S. soldiers sent to save the Iraqis by those same people, it is not unexpected that our soldiers would respond in kind.
Well, I think that some of your previous guests have adequately responded to that. The fact is that this kind of behavior puts our own soldiers in serious jeopardy in the future. The other thing I guess I'd say about this is that we often hear the argument. It's the so-called ticking bomb argument, even as respected academics as Alan Dershowitz of Harvard Law School have made it. We often hear the argument that torture or violent interrogation is justified because it may provide us information that we will be able to use to save lives in the future. What we're seeing here is that the results of this kind of interrogation have a terrifically derogatory impact upon the reputation of the United States around the world. And in the long run, while we may have gained some information, we don't know whether these interrogations gained information or not that was useful to save lives, in the long run, we will, I think, here have done far more damage and put far more people, Americans and Iraqis, in jeopardy than had we not undertaken this interrogation in the first place.
Here's a caller. Steve joins us from Minneapolis.
Hi, yes. Thank you, Neil.
Mm-hmm.
I'd point out one other failing, in addition to the other ones that Mr. Schultz has eloquently listed, and that's the media. I mean, a year ago, you could have been interviewing Mr. Schultz instead of today, and maybe that would have prevented today, this recent scandal and of torture. But in any event, I'd like to also point out that your earlier guests were wrong when they answered your question about how many detainees or whether or not detainees are innocent. The internal report that Cy Hirsch exposed
in the New Yorker magazine, yes.
Thank you. Exposed that over 60% of the detainees are innocent of any crimes. Now, that's the military itself saying that. That's not some, radical saying that. That's the military itself saying that in the internal report. So, I mean, it seems to me also that if these people are, and they definitely are, there's no question that there are many, many innocent detainees in those prisons, you know, what exactly can they do in terms of getting any redress, any kind of compensation or any justice? Can they do anything about this? I mean, there are still, even in that report by the general, in the internal report, he reported there's a man named Steve Stefanowicz, who was a contractor who was at that prison. He recommended that this man be removed from the prison and that he be censured, right, and punished. And he's apparently probably still there. I mean, this is one contractor who the military has known is at that prison for a long time and still, even today, hasn't done anything.
I'm not sure that Mr. Schultz has any too much information about that one contractor, but perhaps he can answer Steve's question. And thanks very much for the call, Steve, about the you know, the what compensation, what rights do these detainees have? What can they get any redress?
Well, I think it, unfortunately, is probably highly unlikely that they will get any kind of redress. Amnesty International believes that there should be international inquiries, not just U.S. military inquiries into this, and that if...
And who would conduct those?
Those could be conducted under any number of auspices. They could be conducted by independent human rights organizations. They could be conducted under the auspices of the United Nations or under a combination of the new Iraqi governing authority and other representatives, including those of the U.S. The structure of that inquiry is not as important as the fact that it can't be the U.S. military alone investigating itself, that indeed when there are potential civilians involved, as it seems good reason that at least some of them are, that they deserve some kind of compensation or at least, I would say, an apology.
William Schultz, thank you very much for being with
thank
us today.
Thank you, Neil.
William Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. He's the author of Tainted Legacy, 9/11 and the Ruin of Human Rights, and he joined us from his office in New York City.